Tailwind Nutrition is joy in a little satchel.
You know, Scott, I recently had the opportunity to pace a runner at San Diego 100.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy course. I would say technical. There are spots that are technical. You always have to watch your foot. And it is exposed, it's open, and it was a very hot year this year. And I had the chance to run with the people looking at the cutoffs. We were the last group of five or seven of us working together. And so incredible to watch the front of a race, but to be right there in the back where the time is as important as the people up front of bringing it home. Because at any time, your bib can be pulled because you don't make it through. And watching just the determination and the guts and the drive and to get to that next aid station on time.
And in many cases, that's where the real race is.
Oh,
it's not at the front. It's at the back.
It's where the heart is exposed.
We know that from Gunhild Swanson, last year's Western States 100. That was an amazing finish.
We were pulling into some aid stations with 5 minutes left to go before they'd actually, you know, blow the horn or cut your ribbon. And it made me think of Gunhild at Western States last year with only 6 seconds on that clock. And 5 minutes seemed close to us. At one point, we were running through, and a gentleman put his head up against the tree, one of our group of five to seven, that continued to change places over and over again. And he said, "You know I can make this in the 32-hour cutoff, but I don't know if I can make this next aid station." And I thought, wow, you know, what a story, what determination. He just, "I can get 32, but I don't know if I can get to that next aid station in time." And he did. And it, you know, was a successful race for him. But just watching that end and seeing these athletes do what they're doing, just loved every second of it.
And that's one of the things that I think draw many of us, including myself, to this sport, is that whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're not racing against the clock, you're not racing against the person next to you at the starting line. You're racing against your own will, your own brain. And at least that's the reason why I like this sport.
Yeah, there's a race out there for everybody. You know, you're racing against yourself. You're racing against the mountain. You're racing against the sun. You're racing against the clock. And you're racing against all those doubts that you have in your mind when you're thinking, gosh, can I just keep it going? And it does take good gear, good equipment, good nutrition. A tailwind at your back certainly helps to get it done.
And that's one of the variables that you can take out of the equation. If you try tailwind, you'll find that it does give you the electrolytes, it does give you the calories that you need, it won't upset your stomach, it doesn't have that palate fatigue that we just talked about,
we will be talking about.
Try it, see if it helps you.
There's a lot of people using it for a lot of good reasons, and that's how we learn to use the right gear, because information is passed along, so we pass this forward to you, put some in a bottle, shake it up, and go out and run.
Go to trailrunnernation.com. Go to our partners page.
Harry's. Harry's Razors.
Harry Razors. We've been talking about it for years now. It's because we believe in the product.
I thought it's because we shaved with it.
Well, of course we use what we believe in.
Okay.
I want to talk to you about the razors. Okay. So it's convenient. It's easy. They're pretty cool. But the bottom line is the razors are awesome. They're sharp.
You know why I like this, Scott? I like it because this is all wide open. I don't have any idea what you're going to say, and I just can't wait because I know you've done some research. So go ahead.
Tell me about Harry's razors. It's very inexpensive. It's a great value. The razors themselves, I don't know if you've gone out and bought a razor in the store, and the handle's virtually free, but then you have to go buy the blades, and the blades are like super expensive.
Yeah.
With Harry's, you're paying less than $2 per blade, per razor blade. And if you compare that with anything in the store, you're going to be blown away. So it's a great value, and the razors are razor sharp.
They're quality.
Big-time
quality. And Scott, right now you have a little bit of, you know, mountain man going on right now.
I do.
Stubble. And I've got to tell you, you know, if a Harry's razor can manage that thing, That's a good razor.
I will tell you, when you do have some growth and you go back in the shower and you start shaving with a normal razor, it kind of hurts.
Yeah.
With the Harry's razor, it's as if you had only a day's growth. It's that quality. If you go to harrys.com and enter the code TRN, you get $5 off. So the Truman set, $15 Truman set, it only costs you $10.
Yes, delivered right to your doorstep.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. Every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today we are days away from the 2016 Western States 100. And we have a former winner.
Yeah.
And two-time podium finisher of Western States, Stephanie Howe, with us. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Stephanie has made running's not only a passion of hers, but she has actually turned it into a little bit of a career. She has a degree in health and fitness management, a master's in exercise physiology, and I hope we get to talk to her about just finishing up her doctorate degree in nutrition and exercise physiology. Is that true? You just finished that up?
I just finished. Yeah, graduation was June 11th. So I'm a doctor now.
So Dr. Howe, thank you for joining Trail Runner Nation.
Hey, you know, you thought you went through the tough spot on the dissertation. We want to hear a little bit about, what was your dissertation about? What did you have to do? What research did you get into?
It was a really cool study. I really wanted to do something that was applied, that was going to be meaningful to me. So I measured appetite hormones in female runners before and after two different intensities of exercise. So basically what that consisted of was getting 15 highly trained competitive women to come into the lab on four different occasions and let me run them through this exercise protocol for about an hour, and then have them sit in a chair following that for an hour and not eat anything and get poked for blood draws about five times. Mm. So it was not an easy task. And the analysis afterwards, I was measuring appetite hormones, so I had to freeze the blood samples. I had to drive to Wyoming, drive them on dry ice, and then analyze everything. So it was just this big two-year-long ordeal.
Wow.
It was really cool. I learned a lot.
Did you have to talk some of your friends into doing it, becoming guinea pigs?
I was asking, are those 15 people still your friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, really. You kind of have to be careful just with the ethics committee about, you know, getting your friends into the lab. You have to be really just kind of, you can give them information about it, but you can't push people into your study. So everyone that did participate was a friend of mine, though. So I'll just leave it at that.
So I have never even heard of an appetite hormone. What is an appetite hormone, and what results did you find from this study? Did you have a theory going in, and was that confirmed, or what?
We definitely had a couple hypotheses going in. And to back up, appetite hormones, there's dozens of them, and they're all, you know, released in different areas of your body. And they're integrated in the hypothalamus in your brain, and they either stimulate or suppress appetite. And it's kind of based on energy availability. It's based on meals that you've consumed, the composition of the foods that you've consumed. So there's all of these different signals. And then there seems to be three or four hormones that are influenced by exercise. And so I measured three of those hormones, and my study was kind of unique because there's been a lot of studies done in obese and sedentary individuals, because that's the health concerns. You get funding for that. And there's been a handful of studies done in active men, but none in active women. Mm-hmm. And so mine was kind of the first that looked at what is the difference in active women. And we knew what happened in men, and mostly we find that appetite is suppressed following exercise for about 60 minutes. The three hormones that you measure, or that we measured, two of them are appetite suppressants and one is an appetite stimulator. So one of them we found was suppressed, and two of them we found were higher. And that's kind of the net effect is suppression. So we definitely found that in the women, it was similar to the men, that appetite was suppressed for about an hour after exercise, and then it was back up to baseline. And interestingly, we found that there was no difference between exercise intensity. So we measured a moderate and a high intensity. So it was really cool.
So I guess my question, I mean, we're actually putting together a formulation of an upcoming podcast on nutrient timing. And I guess my question for you is, with these natural occurring hormones that suppress appetite for 60 minutes after exercise, whether moderate or intense, is that nature's way of saying don't eat 60 minutes after, or is there an advantage to trump the hormone and take in some type of nutrition within that 60 minutes? And I'll preface that with, you know, one of our good friends, Sonny Blende, has always taught us that, you know, within the first 30 to 40 minutes after exercise, you should get in 400 calories to restore your glycogen cells. So what did you find out? What do you know about that? How can you help us?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that's kind of like where I bridge the gap from here's my study and what does that mean in application? So kind of our finding for active individuals is that appetite is suppressed following exercise, but there is a 30 to 40 minute window right after exercise where you need to fuel. Even though you're not feeling hungry, you need to refuel, you need to replenish your glycogen stores, and refueling during that time also helps start repair the muscle damage. So that's absolutely correct that you need to eat during that time. And it's not necessarily a physiological, like your body telling you that you shouldn't eat. It's more a result of the mechanical damage specific to running. So in other modes of exercise, there is some suppression, but it's not quite as extreme as running. The three appetite hormones that seem to be influenced by exercise, two are released from the gut and one is released from the stomach. So they're thought, we don't exactly know why, but we think that they're released due to the mechanical jarring of the stomach. Because if you think of running and all the, you know, jump, like each stride, you're putting a lot of, you know, stress on your body. Whereas like spinning, cycling, or swimming, you may not have that same jostling effect.
That just opens up a whole other question for me. In a 50 mile, 50K, maybe even in a 100K, 100 mile race, how do these appetite hormones, I assume they're just saying no more food, no more food, but yet you still have to pound the food. How do you have any theories on that or experience with that?
Yeah, definitely. Most of the feelings of not wanting to eat during exercise have to do with the blood flow is shunted away from your stomach. So it's going to your working muscles, which makes sense. Your muscles are contracting, they need more oxygen, so blood flow goes there. So that leaves little blood flow to your stomach for digestion. So you're just not going to feel those hunger cues as much. And so it's really important to take in, I mean, you have to take in fuel, especially the longer the race, the more important it is. But taking in something that's really simple is going to be important because you can't really digest it as well. And the higher the intensity, the less ability to digest. So I think when we see results from scientific studies, we think black and white, like this is an absolute. But when you take it out of the literature, there's a lot of gray areas. So within that, you have to really figure out what works for you. In a 100 miler, definitely you have some ability to digest food. You're not just fueling the activity, you're also fueling your body to stay alive for a full day.
Yes, so that's interesting. What are some of the takeaways that you had after the study? How did you change some of your pre-race, during race, or post-race fueling?
Well, it kind of just confirmed a lot of what I already knew. And it's been really cool, just my studies in nutrition. I think it's helped my performance a lot just with the fueling. It's kind of just more, I guess, I can refer my study or reference myself to my clients when I'm talking about nutrition. Like, hey, look at this. You know, we have really good evidence that you need to fuel after and you're not going to feel hungry. So for me, with my nutrition, I just really, it's really important that I fuel well during activities and during a race, that's 200 to 300 calories an hour. And then after, within, I try to get it immediately, but within 30 minutes, you're just getting something in your body. And everyone's looking for that perfect food, like this, you know, protein shake or this, you know, bar that's, but really it doesn't matter as much what it is, just something. Ideally, you want mostly carbohydrate, more of a simple carbohydrate so you can break it down and use it really fast. But I'd rather have someone eat something that they can tolerate or they enjoy rather than forcing down something terrible.
Hey, Don, I don't know if you've seen her blog. But if you haven't, you probably need to steer clear of her blog because there are, it's like a a menu of goodies. She has recipes on there, and I'll tell you what, some of them look freaking amazing. I saw the one for homemade Reese's peanut butter cups.
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I like food. What can I say?
I can see how this is kind of your thesis or. Has kind of
chased
evolved,
her passion.
Evolved from your passion, yeah.
You know, nutrition is so important. We all feel great at the beginning of a race. We feel like we can run forever, but then the wheels start to fall off when we start to lose probably part of our fueling mechanism, part of our hydration, there's something that a wheel does fall off, and there are several wheels on this cart of ours that goes down the trail, but nutrition is a key one. And without that, you're just negative. Head talk, chatter goes on, you start to cramp. I mean, just many things happen that go south for a run. And really, if we can just maintain that nutrition down the trail some way efficiently, it's good.
And I'll parlay on that.
Parlay? Steph, that's nice, that's Scott. Did you come in with that word today?
You know, I wrote it down. I this is one word I wanted to use during the podcast, parlay. Stephanie, I mean, you're an accomplished ultra runner. How do you fuel? Do you have stomach issues that you can't process the food or how do you force calories down when your stomach and your appetite hormones are saying no more food?
That's a great question, and I work with a lot of different people too, so I've had a lot of like troubleshooting and working through these things. So for me, it's been more of like I've learned how to do it. I've learned like what your body needs through the education I've had. And I just applied that to myself. I'm really good about like just doing things. Like if I know it's going to help me, I'm going to do everything I can to set myself up for success. So a few years ago, when I started, well, I did my first 100 miler a couple of years ago. And that's when I was really like, okay, you've got to nail this nutrition. And I've really, I wouldn't say I don't have stomach issues. I mean, I do at times. I think everyone does in a 100 miler, but I know how to troubleshoot through them and I know what to do to get myself back out. And for the most part, when people have stomach issues, it's a couple of key mistakes they make. The first one is that they're not fueling early enough. So they're waiting until like an hour, 2 hours in, until they start to feel like they're bonking and then they begin fueling. And by that time, it's too late. And then also the second one is they don't fuel enough. And as I mentioned earlier, your blood flow is diverted from your stomach to your muscles. And so when you eat something, even a gel, it does take a little bit for the blood flow, a little more blood flow to come to your stomach to digest that. And if you think of like, instead of turning a faucet on full, if you just think about keeping a steady stream, like a trickle, of blood flow to your stomach by fueling often, you're going to avoid more of those GI problems. So when I review like a nutrition plan with someone, most of the time it's one of those two issues. They're not starting early enough and they're not fueling with enough. And for me, I use gels for the most part. I'll mix it up in 100 because you have a little more ability to eat real food. So I'll do like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I like the Clif Savory pouches. Mm-hmm. It helps prevent palate fatigue. Mm-hmm. And I'll mix it up with blocks too. So I'm getting a little bit of a different mixture. But everyone is different in what they need. And you have to find that right recipe to prevent stomach distress and to keep you fueling. So some people, it might be all vanilla gels. Some people might need just strawberry blocks, and it might change if it's hot out, if it's cold out. The time of day can influence it. So it's simple, but it's complex when you compare individuals.
Now, Stephanie, you took my word that I had written down to use today. Scott, yours was
palate fatigue.
That was absolutely my word of the podcast. So you got it, Stephanie. Hey, Dr. Howe, you've been through plenty of aid stations, right? And you've had all kinds of advice come at you. Now, without mentioning any names or any particular aid stations, what percentage of that advice is reliable? Do you have a number for us? That's the only answer I need. Go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, Stephanie, I mean, Dr. Howe,
yes,
mentioned that she did her first 100-miler a couple years ago. And yeah, correct me if I'm wrong here, Stephanie, that first 100-miler was Western States, and you won.
That is correct.
Yeah, so evidently she got something dialed in. Her nutrition plan worked.
I will say it worked, but it did. I did have to modify it on the fly because it was working until suddenly it wasn't working. And I didn't just shut down when my stomach started to feel a little bit sloshy. I just switched what I was doing. So I was feeling with gels, and that at mile 80, I was just done. So I switched to Sprite. So I fueled the last 20 miles with Sprite.
I think that's something that's very important. You know, even though your stomach is saying no food, no food, no food, I think you need to listen to your body. And when it says I'm done with those gels, no more gels, you switch it up. And
exactly.
in my case, I like to even switch it up along the way so that I don't get that palate fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do like that word.
Back to the word of the day, the palate fatigue, I think that's a good strategy, is to switch it up early. So you're kind of always looking forward, or maybe not looking forward to, but you're less disgusted by the next flavor you're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important. And I always save my favorite flavors for later. Nice. I have this Cliff Espresso gel that's in a platinum package, and that's like my rocket fuel for later. And I save it.
A nice reward.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of goes back to the theme that we keep hearing over and over, and that is listen to your body. That palate fatigue is a way of your body saying something different down here. We need the stomach communicating. Hey, listen, send me something different.
I need some watermelon.
Along those same lines, you know, I have a fueling plan that I follow, but when I go into an aid station, if something looks good, mm-hmm, I go for it. And I recommend that to most people too, because that is your body telling you something. If potato chips sound good, it's probably because you need the salt or fat. So I think listen to that.
So Stephanie, you do some coaching. How much coaching, when you bring in a new person, do you feel they need more coaching in the actual, you know, the running itself, either the gait or their program
mechanics?
That they're doing? Not their mechanics, but just training, you know, how much
schedule
they run, training schedule, or nutrition. Where do you think that people need the most help?
It depends on the person, honestly, and I think they're really interrelated. Mm-hmm. That's been a really cool thing about having a background in exercise and nutrition, because you can't really do one without the other. Most runners have a pretty good grasp on eating healthy. They at least know, you know, what you need to do on a day-to-day basis. But so I work more on the training with them. But they do need a lot of help on the fueling. I found that's one thing that was really eye-opening to me was that most runners don't fuel very well. I shouldn't say most, but a lot of them could really work on their fueling. And if you're spending all this time training and trying to be at your highest level, then your nutrition should support that.
Is there anything on an aid station table that we should just stay away from? I'm thinking Oreo cookies.
The Vaseline. The communal Vaseline jar, Don. Stay away.
You know, I think using aid stations as a supplement to what you already have is important. And again, listening to your body, I wouldn't try something that's really out of your comfort zone. You know, if you don't ever eat chocolate, which would be really weird, I wouldn't have M&Ms, you know, just like something that's within your safe boundaries, within reason. I will say this last year at UTMB, my body fell apart, like my stomach fell apart. And I just needed to get out of that bonking state. And I left the aid station. Well, first in the aid station, I ate just the meat sauce off of the pasta, like bowls of meat sauce. which is not something I would ever crave. And then I walked out of the aid station with little blocks of cheese, which is, again, not something I would normally feel with. So sometimes I think you can think outside of the box in desperate situations.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting, the difference between the aid stations in Europe, but like UTMB, they have pasta with meat sauce and cheese chunks.
Yes.
You'd never see, I haven't seen a race that I've been to that had spaghetti.
We were in Italy, though, so I think that's kind of mandatory.
it goes with the boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dang, I had a good question. I can't remember what it was.
We'll decide whether it's good, Scott.
I can't remember what it is. Go ahead. Do you have one on?
Well, I'm ready to get into some simple rules. One of the things that we talk about.
I'll come back. I should have made a note on this good question. It was probably the best question of the podcast, and it's now lost.
Well, it'll come back. And simple rules for those that have listened are it's a complex world out there, especially when we're ultra running or trail running, all kinds of complex decisions, what to eat, what not to eat, how fast to go, you know, what gear to wear. A lot of things are out there that can either help us or sabotage us as we need to make those decisions. And as you know, it's tough to do math at the end of a run. How do you make these complex decisions when you can't even do some simple math? So that's where simple rules come in. What kind of boundaries or guidelines can you set forth when your brain's working so that you can execute later? I think
so you don't have to think about it.
No thinking allowed. Dr. Howe, that's why we have you. We want to know some of your simple... I like the ring of Dr. Howe.
It does sound good.
It does sound good, yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of your simple rules? Let's take a topic and just kind of talk a little bit about it. And Scott, at any time,
if the question comes back up,
just stop us in midstream. Okay. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Yeah. So the number one rule I have that pops into my head when I think about simple rules is eat real food. Mm. We can make nutrition really complex. We have all of these diets and constrictions and restrictions and allergies and, you know, eating this macronutrient. And it's like, just think about it as food. You know, a lot of the stuff we can buy in a grocery store is overwhelming, all these choices. But the best way to eat is to eat things that are in their natural state. So real food.
That's a really good one.
Not processed, not stuff that has an ingredients label with, it looks like a chemistry class.
Stay on the perimeter of the grocery store is what I've been told, right?
Stay on the perimeter, yeah.
What's your position on the lower carbohydrate, higher fat, higher protein? Do you subscribe to that, or have you tried it, or have you had some of your athletes try it so you can see what happens to them?
Okay, no. So in the scientific community, there is a lot of good science on nutrition and endurance performance. And carbohydrate is an important piece of that. And I just got back from a conference where I heard a couple really great speakers just talk about it so eloquently. And I just wish I could record them and play it back because they do it so much better than I do. But carbohydrate is really important. I definitely do not subscribe to a diet that limits carbohydrate. I don't subscribe to any diet. I think a diet, rather than thinking about as something, some rules you have to follow, a diet is what I eat. And I think that's a much better way to think about it. So it's made up of the foods that you choose to consume. I think all three nutrients are important, carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. And I also think there's a big misconception about the high-fat diet. A lot of people think they're doing high-fat, but truly, a high-fat diet is about 60 to 70% of your total intake from fat,
wow,
which is a crazy high amount. So, I mean, I'm a fan of limiting processed carbohydrates. I don't think you should base your diet on a lot of breads and pastas and things out of a box, but I think fruits and vegetables and whole grains are super important. And, you know, cutting out something like grains, in the long run, that's not necessarily a good thing because they have a lot of nutrients in them, specifically the B vitamins, which are hard to get from other sources. And B vitamins are really important for energy metabolism. So I think a lot of times when people say, oh, I'm on a low-carb diet, high-fat diet, they're actually more or less just eating healthy because they're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables. Sometimes people don't realize those are carbohydrates, and they're eating maybe moderate amount of fat and protein. So I think without getting too fired up about this, carbohydrates are my friend.
You know, I think when we speak about fat adapted, so I think where we lose track of, I think what that means, fat adapted, in my opinion, and doctor, you can correct me if I'm wrong, certainly, that it means fat adapted, being able to utilize our own fat stores efficiently to move us ourselves down the road. And that's fat adapted, not necessarily learning how to eat fat. And
exactly.
And we look at Zach Bitter, who has, you know, done what Zach has done, run the 100 miles in 11 hours and 40 minutes and around the track. And he's a great fat adapted runner, but he's still taking in your magic number and Sonny Blinde's number, 200 to 300 calories per hour in carbohydrate source to help fuel that machine down the road.
And if you remember back to our podcast with Zach, he said exactly what Stephanie said. He trickled in those carbohydrates.
Yeah,
it wasn't, you know, wait 2 hours, have a gel. He was trickling those carbohydrates in. So I think that this is substantiated with Dr. Howe.
The second time you heard trickle, you thought that it only took twice.
Maybe that's a key word.
Yeah,
I think, you know, a fat adapted is kind of another term that's thrown around really loosely and misunderstood. You know, I think the best way to become fat adapted is through manipulating your training. So doing your slow runs at the correct intensity, not too hard, doing your speed work at the high intensity to get that upper end fitness, but making sure you're not just staying in that middle no man's land. Yeah. And that's something that runners can get caught up in, is just running their distance runs too fast. I do want to point out, and I think people don't realize this either, that even when you're using the maximum amount of fat that you can, you're still using carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. There's no one who can use 100% fat. It's, you know, you couldn't be moving. And the other thing that was presented at this conference that I didn't really think about before and I thought was really interesting was, yes, fat is a fuel that we have a lot of on our body. We have many stores of fat, whereas glycogen, we can deplete those stores really fast. But to use fat, it requires a lot of oxygen to break it down. And so running at a given pace, I'm just going to pick a random pace, 8 minute mile, say if you're using just fat, you're fat adapted, quote unquote, you're at a higher percentage of your VO2 than if you're using kind of both sources, carbohydrate and fat. So that's kind of interesting if you think about it from a performance standpoint too.
You may be more efficient using a blend of both, some of the carbohydrate and fat, is what I'm hearing you say.
Definitely. And kind of like you said earlier, taking in more fat doesn't mean you're going to burn more fat. The limiting, I'm just going to geek out for a second, the limiting reagent, the limiting step on fat oxidation is transporting fatty acids from the outer to the inner mitochondria. It goes through a transporter called CPT1 and CPT2, and it uses something called carnitine. So it's not actually mobilizing fatty acids. So taking in more doesn't mean you're going to burn more. It's actually that rate limiting step of getting it into the mitochondria and through beta oxidation.
Scott will have that completely on show notes about beta oxidation and the transport.
I'd like to go back
chain.
To palate fatigue. No, I'm joking.
You want to parlay to palate fatigue.
You know, we've talked about this with a number of nutritionists and doctors on the podcast in the past, but I want to make sure that you also agree with this. Calories in, calories out is the wrong way to formulate a good health.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I totally agree with that. Your body is not a checkbook. It does not work like that. It is way more complex. Just all those appetite hormones I was talking about earlier, that's just like a small fraction of how your body tries to regulate your energy balance. And it's so much more complex than, oh, I burned 500 calories. I must eat 500 calories.
Scott, was that the question you had saved up?
No,
that was
no,
the greatest
no,
but, question on but, the podcast ever.
But I just remembered what it is.
Oh, good.
Oh, good.
So there's appetite hormones that you talked about. There's 12 of them. There's some appetite hormones that suppress, some that make you want to eat more. How do I get more of those suppressing hormones active in my body?
So that's the thing. And that's usually what happens with research. You try to extrapolate it. So this is how your body works to keep your energy in balance. It's not something you want to manipulate.
Okay.
And also just taking in, so I said they're released in your body and then they're integrated in your hypothalamus, in your brain. So injecting yourself, let's say you were to inject yourself with PYY, that's one of the appetite suppressing hormones. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cross the blood-brain barrier and influence appetite in your central, in your brain. And it's just because it's in your circulation doesn't mean it's going to cause more appetite suppression. So I would say those hormones aren't something that we want to like try to manipulate. It's more, I think focusing on lifestyle is probably more of a better way to go.
And probably easier.
And maybe I've oversimplified it because I don't want to try to manipulate these hormones, but I simply take a belt and put it around my chin and my top of my head and crank it down.
Tighten it down.
During my waking hours.
Yeah. There you go. You could also like break your jaw and then just
take a liquid diet.
That's possible.
My brother did that once.
Hey, well, what about the people that sew their stomachs together? I mean, that, you know, do they try to minimize the size to manipulate?
Oh, that's a great question.
It's not really a good question.
Yeah, no, it is. I like it.
It's not a good way to go because you have to be so careful with what you take in because it can be really easy to become nutrient deficient. So if you think about not having much room in your stomach to absorb nutrients or to eat food, you don't have any room to eat like, you know, those extra foods. So like cookies or like ice cream, you have to be really, really careful about what you eat and everything has to be quality or else you're going to be unhealthy.
Yeah, and if people took that same strategy and pretended like they had this surgery and ate less and ate the right foods, they'd be better, much better off. Because there's different, there's different areas.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's all about moderation. You know, I think, and this is kind of back to my simple rules. I think food should be enjoyed. It should be a pleasurable experience. Like sharing a meal with someone is a really intimate thing, and it, you know, we complicate it and we stress about it, and people get anxiety, but food, you should like food and you shouldn't feel guilty about eating things. So it's just about like, it's more of an intuitive thing and just being happy with, I guess, what you're eating and not really getting super worried about, you know, calories or meal size and that sort of thing.
Well, and the one thing that I was going to say is I've changed my lifestyle intake of food to include more real foods. I found that I eat less. And I think that's a big problem with many people is just the volume of food. And I think that goes back to some of those refined carbohydrates you were talking about. I mean, you can eat those forever and not get full. But bringing in some good proteins and some good fats kind of help that your appetite suppress a little bit. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're just filling your body with like really good quality nutrients. And real food tends to have more fiber in it. And also it's, we call it low energy dense food, which means it has higher water content per gram weight. So it's going to fill you up on less. And I think there's nothing better than preparing your own foods from scratch. It's, you know, we always say like, oh, this is made from scratch. It, you know, that's such a big deal. It's really not that big a deal. It's not that hard to put foods together. And I think that enhances, the, just kind of your feelings around meals and foods. And it, you tend to eat better sized portions. I think when you're thinking about it, you're preparing things. You're not just like grabbing a cheeseburger at the drive-thru.
How do you, let's say you get a new, coaching pupil and they're, their nutrition is terrible. You know, they eat out fast food, they eat processed food. How do you begin to put some training wheels on to this lifestyle change? What is your method of breaking them into changing that lifestyle change that they've developed for decades?
Method maybe? Of manipulation.
Oh, lifestyle changes are really hard. So the first thing I do is actually have them keep a diet record for a week. Mm-hmm. And I have them do this before we talk about anything nutrition. I don't want them to change any of their habits. So I get this full week of diet logs from them and I enter them into this program that I have. And it gives me this really comprehensive report of everything they're getting. And then I usually spend about an hour, sometimes more, going over that with them. And then from there, I talk about the recommendations, and I like to get into the science a little bit so they understand why they need certain things. I don't want to just say eat this, because if you don't have any reason to do it, it's hard to follow that. And then when I start to have people change, I have them take small steps. So if I give them like 10 things to try all at once, it's like that's setting them up to fail. So we start with something small, like maybe, you know, making dinner every night at home, or maybe making their lunch every other day, or something like that, you know, changing their breakfast, small steps. And then once that becomes part of their normal habit, then we start to really refine it even more. It takes a while for it to be sustainable. And I don't give people meal plans like eat these foods, because I want them to think for themselves, because it's not sustainable if I just give them a list of foods to eat. So we work together within a given framework to kind of come up with what healthier eating patterns would be.
You know, before we get on to the next simple rule, unless you had a follow up there, Scott, and this is totally kind of off base, but you know what amazes me about the body is its ability to adapt and just to maintain its existence. When you look at somebody that's homeless or has elected to live on the corner, and their main nutrition is in a brown paper bag, whatever may be in that, and I don't think it's a nutrition shake. How is it that their body is able to reproduce the eyeball, the pancreas, their muscles, their just keep things going at the very small margins for, you know, homeostasis, to keep everything balanced? And the body's able to do that on some rum or whatever is in there. The body's incredible.
The body is amazing, and it can survive off a lot of different things. But the thing with, you know, drinking rum for your main calories is your necessary functions are going to be prioritized. So your brain, your sight, your smell, your taste, your essential organs. But everything else is going to kind of, I don't want to say fall apart, but it's going to be less prioritized. So over time, that's really not going to be, it's not going to be a sustainable, you know, your body's just going to start to fall apart. But, you know, it really can protect those main things to keep you alive, which is incredible. There's redundancies upon redundancies, and the body is like, every time I learn more, I'm just amazed. Like, the more I learn, the less I know.
The body will cannibalize, take other parts and different muscles and use that as a protein source and calcium and you name it. It just, like you said, can take a hormone and spin it wherever it is, whether it's in the liver or somewhere, and create what it needs to create to keep it moving. And you're right. It's an incredible vehicle of ours. And when we treat it right, as you're talking about, Stephanie, with proper nutrition, then it can do extraordinary things like run all day or all night on a trail.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. So the first simple rule of Stephanie's is eat real foods. Do you have another one for us? Another simple rule?
Yeah, I do. And this is kind of thinking about like pre-race, like the night before a race, the day before a race. And I would say it would be chill the F out.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Relax. So I kind of equate this to if you remember back to like high school or college and you go into a classroom the day of an exam and you see everyone like scrambling, like looking at their notes, like trying to memorize last minute things. And like that would drive me bonkers. I would just like go in with a pencil and just sit there. And all those people just like scrambling. I'm like, just chill out. You're making yourself a nervous wreck. And I kind of see that with a lot of pre-race stuff too. And right now I'm in SWAT right before Western States.
Yeah.
And it hasn't quite started yet, but I have seen a few people and they're just all, you know, a nervous ball of energy. And at this point, you've prepared. There's nothing that you can do to make it better. You can drive yourself bonkers and maybe sabotage your race by becoming a head case or, you know, I've seen people like last minute making all these changes, like, oh, I saw this person putting this fuel in this drop bag. And it's just like, go with what you know, just like let it go. The less you can kind of worry about those things, the more you can focus on, you know, your race or relaxing.
So what is your favorite go-to activity the day before the race to chill out?
You know, I like to go for a walk. And then I like to hibernate. Normally I find when I'm just like in my room, like, I don't know, I just like dink around, like make a playlist on music or like, you know, just do stuff like on my computer or watch a TV show. If I'm outside, I'm around all those people and they stress me out. Mm-hmm. So I tend to kind of hibernate, and I'm with the people that relax me, like my husband, two of my good friends. They're usually around race day. And then I always make dinner in my room. And this is super lame, but also awesome. I usually go to bed by 8 p.m.
Oh, yeah. 8 p.m. is the time that I'm trying to figure out where my tape is to mark my drop bag. So,
yeah.
That's which
or to find out where your shoes are. I only have one left shoe here.
Yeah. or moves into 10 o'clock when I'm trying to get my bib pinned on straight. Yeah. So,
I will say, I've done that. There are some races where I don't take it as serious, or I'm not as prepared and I'm scrambling last minute and I'm just like, why do I do this to myself?
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't feel as good.
I do like to show up just before the gun goes off though, because you get out there, you can lose 2 to 3 miles worth of energy just in all the hype. It's like, wow, so much.
I'm with you on that. I like to roll in right before the start. I mean, you're not going to warm up for a 100-miler.
No.
Lake Sonoma, the past 2 years I've done it, I didn't do it this last year, but the 2 years before that, I almost missed the start. I always miscalculate how long it takes to get there. And I seriously rolled in one morning at he said 1 minute to go. It was perfect. I didn't have time to think, to get nervous. I just pinned on my bib and started. That's good.
Yeah, that's I think that's a really, really good rule. And I'll tell you, I think it's kind of tough, especially at these big races like a UTMB and a Western States that has so much electricity. I mean, you're up in Squaw right now and it's Thursday. It's 2 days before the start. And I've been up there 2 days before and the electricity is amazing. So it's really tough to pull away from that.
It is.
Go veg out.
Yep. Yep. You got to have almost force yourself to do it.
Yeah. It's fun to be up there and to be around that stuff. Just as long as you don't get caught up and it becomes a vampire to your energy. That's for sure. Any other simple rules with racing or with any other aspects?
I think with racing, the first thing or the thing that I like to remember is be a good person. I think this kind of goes along with don't chill out and don't take yourself too seriously. But remember that you're a person first. And, be nice on the trail. Thank the volunteers. If you're going to pass someone, tell them good job. If you're mean, you're going to get some bad karma. So I think there's just no need. And I think that's, important to remember to you're human first and an athlete second.
Yeah, that is one that I was not expecting, but is very...
You didn't think she was a nice person?
That's not what I was saying. I just think that's a very good, simple rule. Remember, that's one that when things get, you're at mile 72 and things are, your stomach has gone south and those appetite hormones are saying no more, no more, and you have blisters all over and you have every reason to be cranky. If you're just nice, that'll turn around. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is. Some of my favorite memories from races are actually kindness from people. People have done things for me that I just will remember forever.
Yeah.
And that means a lot.
You know who sets a good example of that is Jimmy Dean Freeman. I saw him come through some aid stations and always smiling, always happy. Yeah. And I know that he wasn't happy deep inside because he just went through some terrific canyons with heat and there was reason not to be happy, but you'd think that was the best day of his life, and he showed that at the aid station. And that's a real good example, an ambassador for the trail.
Yes, so, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'm not sure all groups have that same karma definition or belief. There are some that throw elbows and try to move through quickly. So I'm not going to mention any groups.
Ragnar. Did I say that out loud?
No, you did.
Sorry about that.
I wasn't thinking of that one, but it may or may not qualify.
Well, you can edit that out, right?
If I learned how to edit, I would, pal. Stephanie, what's coming up for you? You're doing a lot of coaching and a lot of training. Tell us a little bit about some of your exploits away from the trail, because you're hugely successful on the trail. How do you help runners become better runners off the trail?
So the most important thing to me in helping a runner is to learn a lot about them. I don't think generic training plans are as effective because they don't take into account all the individual differences between people. So I really like to learn more about a person and not just their physical traits, but also like, what is your personality like? What is your stress level like? What is your work environment like? And kind of take that into account with when I'm thinking about their training and their goals. And as I write a training plan, I just really put myself into this person. Like, I become this person for a second. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like putting myself through it. And then as I start the training plan, I really like to get feedback. I think communication is really important because you can, you know, when you write a training plan, that's if everything goes perfectly. And so that's not real life. And so it involves a lot of communication, a lot of changes along the way. So that's, I think the most important thing for me as a coach is to hear feedback and to communicate with my athletes.
You know, and if you are interested in Stephanie being your coach, you can go to her coaching website, which is endurancebystephanie.com. And she has go ahead.
I have a new website.
Oh, what is it? Let's get that out.
Violet.com.
I'm say it again.
StephanieHowViolet.com.
Violet? You got to explain that.
That's my husband's last name. That is sort of my last name.
Oh, okay.
It is. I just, everyone knows me as Stephanie Howe, so I put Violet on the end. V-I-O-L-E-T-T.
Very, very, very good. Do you have room for new people? Many times there is quite a waiting list.
Yeah, I am pretty full right now, but there's always turnover because there's people that I'm just taking on for a couple of months. So if anyone is interested, I'm always interested in hearing.
Sure.
Are there some candidates that you say I'm not the right coach for? I mean, do you ever turn people away or fire?
I wouldn't say I fire people, but I definitely do a long kind of initial meeting, a phone call or Skype or in person to get to know each other and make sure that we are a good fit. And I usually don't let people just commit to it right away. I encourage them to talk to other people, talk to other coaches, and really go with who they feel best with, because you need to trust your coach 100%. And so, you know, I'm not going to be the best fit for some people, and you have to find that person that really clicks with you. So I guess there have been people that have gone with other coaches, and that's good.
Oh, in those cases, you're right, because you can't take that personally. There are other people that fit other personalities, and maybe they've made a decision that you'll be very grateful for, that they've left and moved on and found that right connection.
Yeah, it's important.
Well, fantastic. What's up? You have anything else, Scott?
I want to know what races you have coming up.
That was my exact question.
What's on your list, Stephanie?
Well, that's a great question. So I had Achilles surgery in December, and that was kind of something that my Achilles had been injured for about a year, and it was just like, it was not a fun thing. So I flew over to Sweden and got the surgery, and it was an incredible experience. So I've been rehabbing that for about the last four or five months, and my foot is finally healthy. So that's like a really, really good, happy thing. Like, I just couldn't remember what it was like not to hurt. So, but in that time I was trying to ramp up, and I realized that it's going to take my body a while to get back into running shape. So I don't really have much planned for this year. I'm kind of taking a little downtime, and it feels really good. I think a safe bet for sure, I'll be doing the North Face in December, and something in the summer fall, but I just haven't really planned it yet.
What did they find with your Achilles? Was it a bone spur, a bursa, or, you know, what was happening?
So I had a big bursa on the back of my heel. That was kind of what was causing the pain generator. Mm-hmm. And what had caused the bursa was the bone in my heel. I had a little bit of a Haglund's deformity, so the bone was rubbing on the tendon, and that produced the bursa. So he removed the bursa and then chiseled the bone. And it was really cool. I during the surgery.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I could like hear him chiseling, and he was just telling me the whole time like what he's doing. He's like, "And now I will chisel the bone." And he like really sounded like a hammer just like chiseling it. And he showed me the bone fragments after, and it was kind of wild.
Yeah,
pretty freaky.
Yeah. But you know, it was a surgeon, that's like what he does, is Achilles surgery. So it was an awesome experience.
Yeah, going all the way to Sweden. You know that you did a little research there, Stephanie, to make sure you found the right person.
I did. Yeah.
So race calendar, not quite anything written in ink. What about dream races or bucket list races? Are there any out there that you want to do again or want to try?
Totally. There's a lot of just runs that I want to do. That's kind of like, you know, doing like the Colorado Trail and Mount Rainier and running a lot in the Alps. Those are all like things that are really on my bucket list. The John Muir Trail, yeah. A lot of places in the U.S. As far as races go, UTMB, I need to go back and spend a little bit less time in the aid stations. I took a 2-hour nap last year, so I would like to have a better experience. UTMF in Mount Fuji, that's something that's kind of been intriguing to me. There's a stage race called the Alto Trail to Mount Rosa. It's this is only its second year. Lizzie Hawker is the race director, and it just looks spectacular. So anywhere in the mountains, in the Alps, those races are really appealing to me. And then, Western States is just a race that means a lot to me. It's, you know, it was my first 100 and, you know, it just, to me, it's more than a race. It's, I just get so excited about it and, the energy and the people. And it's just, it's a race that I will probably keep doing. I don't know if it'll be consecutive years. I could see myself coming back to it a handful of times.
You know, I like how you delineated between racing and just running for the joy and beauty of running and not getting past some of those beautiful vistas as quickly as you can because you're on a schedule to try to stay in the front of the pack. It's, I want to take this at my leisure and take in and soak in some of this trail in this area.
And I realized when I was injured and I had a lot of time to think about running and what it meant to me and why I did it and the things that I missed when I was recovering was running on trails with friends and seeing things. It, you know, very rarely did I think about like a start line or a race. I mean, I love racing, but the things that are really important to me are just seeing these beautiful places and having my feet take me there. And there's so many places that I feel like I'm lucky to see that so many people won't ever have the opportunity. So I love that part of it.
And we've talked about that in the past too, some running adventures. You can get in shape to put a bib on, but you can get in shape to go have an incredible, epic time with friends on the Grand Canyon or you name it, all the places that you name. This is another place to enjoy your fitness and another reason to get out there and get yourself fit so you can take that adventure.
Yes. Yeah.
And the best part is you win. Every time. Every time you win.
That's a good one, Scott. That is good. You parlayed into that very well. So, Stephanie, what are you doing up in Squaw Valley?
Well, my husband is racing, so I'm going to crew for him. It's his first time running Western States. And then I'm also here with Cliff Bar. They're the official nutrition sponsor of the race. And then some of my other teammates from the North Face, and then Drymax is one of my sock sponsors, and Nathan is as well, are all have presence here. So visiting with them and then seeing some of my friends.
Hey, Stephanie, so if you're not racing, do you chill out the night before or are you out there partying?
Well, it's, you know, I was just saying this, like it's a lot more fun being here and not racing because I'm just like drinking wine. I'm out, just, like yesterday I sat in the sun for like 2 hours. So it's a lot more, I just don't have any stress. I'll probably try to be mindful of like my husband needs some downtime and, you know, chill out the day before. But right now I'm having fun.
Did you coach your husband?
You know, we kind of keep that separate. The training and the coaching, he does his own thing. It doesn't really work for me to coach him. We tried it before and it's just, we're too close for that relationship.
Many hundred milers under his belt, or is this his first one ever?
He did UTMB last year and he's done Bighorn. So he's done a couple and he's wanted to get into this race for 5 years. So it's about time.
Yeah. Good for him. Are you going to be crewing down the mountain for him?
I am crewing. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
what about pacing? Does he have a pacer? And
are you applying for the position?
No,
Scott?
No, I'm not that fast, but I'm just wondering, you know, have you ever paced him in a race and does that work as a wife?
Ah,
yes.
Good question.
So when we were dating, like maybe after a year of dating, we did Trans Rockies together, like tethered together, a 6-day stage race. So we got out a lot of that, like figuring out how each other works. So since then, we've been able to pace each other. I paced him at Bighorn, his first 100, and then he paced me at Western States, my 2 years I did it. And this year his brother is pacing him because I'm not really running yet. So I'm crewing for him, and it'll be good to be helpful. But I enjoy pacing him. We know how each other suffers, and I can kind of read him without him having to say much. So it works out pretty well.
That's a good date to learn something about someone you're dating is go
so,
pace them.
So if you want to figure out if it's a good relationship, you should run Trans Rockies together.
Yeah, I've got two daughters that will be getting married one day, I believe, and I'm going to tether them for 6 days in the mountains with their suitor.
Yeah, it's a really good test.
Stephanie, we really appreciate you coming on. We appreciate being able to hear your simple rules.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We would love to have you back anytime you have a topic you want to talk about. We would love to have you back. You are very enjoyable to talk to.
Thank you. Well, we'll have to get something on the books.
Perfect. So is it Dr. Howe or Dr. Violet? Which do?
That's right.
I published as Howe, because I started my PhD before I got married. So I guess Dr. Howe. My husband calls me Dr. Wifey. So
we're just going to call you Fast, and we appreciate you coming on. So go out and run.
Moss.